Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for the Sydney launch of Heartfelt Moments in Australian Rules Football, which is edited by Ross Fitzgerald. I'll introduce the book very briefly. Initially, I should say welcome to the New South Wales Sports Minister, Stuart Ayres, who's here tonight. It's great to see you here. We have three speakers in order. Ross Fitzgerald, who's a contributor to The Weekend Australian, who's an author and professor. We have Gabriel Traynor, formerly on the board of the Greater Western Sydney Giants, but most recently appointed to the AFL Commission, for which we say congratulations. And Chris Kenny, author, commentator, associate editor of The Australian, and of course a host of Viewpoint on Sky News and a regular contributor to Sky News. Now, before I call Ross Fitzgerald, our speakers will speak for about 3 minutes each. I should say something very briefly about the book, which is it contains the following contributors: Ross Fitzgerald, Philippa Power, Brian Dixon, Ken Spillman, Dick Whittaker, Barry Dickens, Peter Lyons, who's the son of the former Australian Prime Minister, James Gilchrist, Frank Dimattina, Phil Taggle, Matt Zabro, Jeff Kennett, Bill Hay, Susan Alberetti, Chris Bowen, George Pell, Liz Everett, Paul Santa Maria, John Burt, Peggy O'Neill, Robert Pascoe, Richard Alsop, Amanda Vanstone, Chris Kenny, Gabriel Traynor, Sally Murphy, Michael Gordon, Julie Bishop, Chris Griffith, Geraldine Du, Jaron Henderson, John Elliott, Joss Frydenberg, Anthony Capello, Andrew Ireland, and Michael O'Loughlin. So they're the contributors, and three of them are going to speak here tonight. First, Ross Fitzgerald, then Gabriel Traynor, and then Chris Kenny. Ross.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Jared, and thanks all for coming. As the 37 contributors to Heartfelt Moments in Australian Rules Football makes clear, Aussie rules football cuts across all divides. Hence this fine collection of original essays by and about football players, supporters and administrators who are vastly different in religion, class, income, ethnicity, gender, race and sexual preference. Contributors to Heartfelt Moments range from devout atheists like myself, Dick Whittaker and Barry Dickens, to believing Christians such as Geraldine Doog, John Burt and Cardinal George Pell, who writes about his heartfelt decision of whether to become a priest or to train and play with Richmond. He was recruited in 1959 and the Richmond Football Club offered to pay his university fees, but as we know, he opted for the priesthood. The reality is that not only unbelievers, but also clerics of all persuasions often highlight Aussie rules. Hence the retired Roman Catholic Archbishop of Perth, Barry Hickey, regularly told this story. An AFL umpire died and found himself at the pearly gates. When he related what he had done on earth, the saint replied, "Well, we can skip purgatory, you've done enough as a football umpire. But is there anything weighing in your conscience that you need to admit before we consider letting you in?" And the umpire said, "There was this match, Collingwood versus St Kilda. Magpies ahead by 3 points, and the St Kilda full forward went for a mark right in front of goal. The sun was in my eyes and I couldn't be sure whether he made it or not, but I gave him the mark and he scored and St Kilda won. Think nothing of it, my son. Come right in." "Oh, thank you. Thank you, St Peter," said the umpire. "I'm not St Peter," replied the saint. "I'm St Kilda." Talk talking of the mighty magpies, my late father Bill, along Tom Fitzgerald, who played over 100 games for Collingwood seconds, but never for the firsts, would regularly recount on my birthday, Christmas Day, a story about the Richmond great Jack Dyer. Dad explained that Dyer, who was commonly known as Captain Blood, often said, "Whenever I have a nightmare, it's never in colour. It's always black and white." Collingwood. On a more earthy note, one of my favourite footballing tales concerns a 20-year-old from the country who was about to play his first senior game. When the coach took him aside and said, "I might have to pull you off at three-quarter time," the lad responded, "Golly, where I come from, we usually only get oranges." Humour's a funny business. My publisher, Anthony Capello, and my wife, Lyndall Moore Fitzgerald, think that this story is highly amusing, whereas Gerard Henderson, who in the book writes about as a child following Essendon star full forward John Coleman, considered it a tad too rude to crack a mention. Contributors to Heartfelt Moments in Australian Rules Football include my techno-savvy colleague from the Australian, Chris Griffith, who writes about Simon Black and the Brisbane Lions. Plus, there are revealing essays by leading ex-players like Brian Dixon, also a Member of Parliament, John Burt, Andrew Arnold and Mickey O'Loughlin, who writes about his inspirational journey with number 37, Adam Goods. As well, there are contributors from Labor's Shadow Treasurer, Chris Bowen, the Liberal Minister for Resources, Energy and Northern Australia, Josh Frydenberg, Australia's Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, and ex-Liberal Federal Minister, Amanda Vanstone. Plus, there are revealing essays from ex-Liberal Party heavyweight John Elliott and ex-Victorian Premier Jeff Kennett, who had been presidents of Carlton and Hawthorn, respectively. Following Collingwood for a lifetime has taught me that Aussie rules football is a metaphor for life. And to take one crucial example, the game is never lost until it's lost. Being and remaining a dyed-in-the-wool barracker is a sign and test of character, just as switching teams seems to me a symbol of a loss of loyalty, faith and heart. Changing clubs for which the barrack, merely because of a team's consistently poor performance, is something that no true supporter would ever entertain. Indeed, it's a sign of true fandom never to let any number of losses interfere with or dilute a passionate and unrelenting supporter for a person's chosen, or in my case, inherited club or team. The fact is that because it's Aussie rules football we are dealing with, a number of contributors explore, directly or indirectly, what it means to be an Australian and or what are key Australian characteristics and personality traits. A number of essays also uncover how, over the decades, our great game has developed, often for the good but sometimes not, in terms of its treatment of Indigenous players and its dealings with women. Being a lifelong supporter of a club, any club, involves a lot of downs and ups. At the very least, to be a true supporter means never giving up or relinquishing one's team. But it means much more than that. Ultimately, it is the downs that enable supporters to show their true colours and the depth of their personal attachment and commitment to each club. Thus, as Roger Kahn wrote in his case about the Brooklyn Dodgers, "You may glory in a team triumphant, but you fall in love with a team in defeat." How true is that? Most importantly, I'd like to thank my friend Dick the Weatherman Whittaker, to whom Heartfelt Moments in Australian Rules Football is dedicated, and who has written a most revealing epilogue about the highs and lows of Aussie rules football weather. So thank you all. Thank you all for coming this evening.
Now with Gabriel Traynor.
Thanks, Jared. I acknowledge we meet on Gadigal land tonight and pay respects to all the elders and thank the Sydney Institute for inviting me here tonight. It was a Saturday in 1969. North Melbourne was at the rock bottom of the ladder. They had never won a premiership, had not made the final since 1954, and were considered perennial easy beats. But the administration had begun recruitment. Recruiting Sam Kekovic, Slamming Sam as he became known, the year before from Myrtleford, and already showing the form that would soon win him best and fairest after booting 56 goals. Slamming Sam takes up the story. With the exception of yours truly, North in those days were dead set hopeless. But we had recruited the brilliant Western Australian rover Barry Cable. He and I were the only two you'd feed. That day, we were playing Geelong down at Cadinia Park. Barry and I drove down the Geelong Road in Barry's new fluorescent green Monaro, and the rest of the team were following in a bus. The two of us arrived at the rooms and spent a good half hour doing our warm-up, idly wondering where the rest of them were. It got to 1:15 and still no sign of them. There was a knock at the door and Jeff Crouch, the field umpire, came in looking a bit worried. "Where are they?" he said. "You'll have to forfeit," he told us. I looked at Barry and Barry looked at me and we said we felt confident we could start the game regardless. So at 2:10 out we went. I had appointed him captain and Barry won the toss and elected to kick with the breeze to the Barwon River End. The siren sounded and it was on. I won in the ruck from the first bounce and made a perfect tap down to Barry, who took off, balked around two players, bounced it three times as he raced down the flank and leapt, ripped with a beautiful left footer 40 yards out for our first goal. Umpire Crouch bounced it again and I again won it out of the centre, passed myself and then popped a perfect shot pass into Barry's waiting arms at centre-half forward. He lined up and goaled again. By quarter time, I'd kicked two majors from set shots and we had a handy lead of 15 points. Barry was on fire in the second and dobbed three to my two. The Cats were still struggling and at the main break, the Kangas were in front by 20. Still no sign of the bus, but both Barry and I felt pretty fresh after a couple of Peter Starvisons and half an orange and we went out for the third term. Big Doug Wade kicked a couple at the other end, but we responded with some superb run and carry, supported by Barry's characteristic bullet-like handballs, to stretch our lead to 32 points at three-quarter time. At the 20-minute mark of the last, I took a screamer near the boundary line in front of the red hickey stand and slid across the line. As I got up to take my kick, I noticed an old racing cobber in the third row. Our eyes locked, and he called to me, "Sam, Sam. Number 5 in the last at Werribee's a cert." I glanced at my watch. Deep in thought, I goaled from an impossibly acute angle, and as we loped back to the centre for the bounce, I said to Barry, "Capes, we're 7 goals up. They can't catch us now. I need to find a TAB, so I'll leave you to clean up here and meet you after the game at the Werribee pub." Cable was agreeable, so I took off. An hour later, Capes wanders into the pub and I order him a beer. The mongrel horse finished 10th, so I was a little testy as I asked Barry how much we'd won by. "But we didn't win, Kecker. We lost by 4 points." I was incredulous. "But we were 45 up with 10 minutes to go. What happened?" "Well, Kecker, the bloody bus turned up." I must apologise for the mild profanity. I'd planned a worse one. But also to Sam for appropriating his ripping football yarn, which he tells with far greater bravura than I. So Ross Fitzgerald has brought us an excellent anthology, giving 37 different answers to the question why we love, how we feel in our hearts about Australian rules footy. Truth be told, there are hundreds of thousands of answers to that question. We love it because it does produce characters like Slamming Sam, like Lou Richards, like Boomer Harvey, who at the age of 38 is lining up again this season and still playing like a midfielder about half his age, like Amra Karan Hassan of the Auburn Giants women's AFL team, mostly comprised of young Muslim women, like Alf Treblecock, who has been volunteering as a boot starter at Port Adelaide Football Club since 1968, like Kevin Sheedy, like Michael Long, like the poet player Bob Murphy, and like the remarkable Daisy Pearce, number one pick in the first AFL women's draft. We love it because it's our game, invented here by an Australian for Australians. The story of Tom Wills, who founded the game, is itself the stuff of legends. Every footy fan should read Greg DeMoor's book, Tom Wills, First Wild Man of Australian Sport. It's a game that captures our spirit and our imagination. One in every 28 Australians is a member of an Australian rules football club. How extraordinary is that statistic? We love footy because of the good it can do. It's the great equaliser. It connects and brings individuals, families and communities together in one joyful conversation, even if your team has lost. It inspires kids to do their best, to run and to shout and to play together. It gives them heroes and in some places is an incentive to go to school, to read, to do your sums. It speaks to important things about living as a member of society and people listen. Footy gives people hope. Of course, there are issues, disappointments, examples of bad conduct, scandals. No doubt footy's had its share of that. How it responds is the test. But there are many, many, many more good things about footy than those that let it down. I love football. It's deep in my DNA. It has given so much to me and my family going back generations. It's been a great privilege to be involved in the most exciting project in sport, that is, playing a part in creating a new AFL team in the west of Sydney, the GWS Giants, and now to have joined the AFL Commission at a time when it's on the cusp of what Gil McLachlan calls a revolution in the shape of the AFL Women's League, and at a time the AFL is investing significantly in the next 30 or 40 years of our game. And it's a privilege to have been asked to contribute to this book in some very august company. It was absolutely a labour of love to write about what Kevin Sheedy means to the Giants and to our game. But most of all, I love it that it's only three more sleeps until season 2016 begins and that there are so many more heartfelt moments in footy to come. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Penny.
Thanks very much, Ross. Jared. Yes, I don't want to get too preachy or serious after all those jokes, but you know, I know that across most of this country, not here in Sydney, I know, but and not in Queensland, but there's no doubt across most of Australia what our greatest game is, especially, of course, when it comes to winter sports. It is our great Indigenous game, Australian rules. Whether you're in Perth or Hobart or Darwin or Adelaide, Alice Springs, Geelong, Crystal Brook, yes, even in Melbourne, Aussie rules is the game that matters. We're born into it. We tend to choose a team early or inherit it, as Ross mentioned, and stick with it with a tribal loyalty all our lives. Now, whether we sit on the high court or we collect garbage, whether we cut hair for a living or we cut big financial deals at the big end of town, footy is a common interest, a common language, a common passion. Man or woman, adult or child, famous or obscure, in the footy states, in the Aussie rules states, we all identify with our code and with our team. It's a great leveller, Aussie rules. It's a truly egalitarian game, and it's one that we all share. Sure, it's spectacular to watch. It's attacking and aggressive in a way that few games are, high-flying and high-scoring. It's all of those things, and that's why we love it. But when you turn your mind to it, as I did for this book and thinking about tonight, it's the way the game binds us together, even across the tribal loyalties, that I think I truly treasure most about Aussie rules. Now, I learnt this through its absence because I hail from Adelaide, hence my Adelaide Crows scarf and my great honour as an Adelaide Crows ambassador. But I've been living here in Sydney for more than 7 years now, and I love this city. You know, what's not to love about Sydney, except for perhaps the traffic and you can't get a drink after 10:30 at night. But, sorry, Minister, I had to chuck that in there. No, truly, I do love Sydney and I love the culture of this town, but when you come from a footy town like Adelaide, something that is immediately obvious is the way the sporting culture is fractured. It's balkanised, it's sectarian. It doesn't have that unifying sporting culture that we have in the Aussie rules states, at least in winter. I think, of course, cricket tends to unite all of us in summer. You turn up for work on a Monday morning in Sydney, and there's a bunch of blokes, and I will say blokes because I think I think the other codes are a little bit more blokey, to be controversial, than Aussie rules. There's a bunch of blokes over there talking about league, or what I like to call Luke. And there's a bunch of blokes over there talking about Union and the Wallabies, and there'll be a bunch of other people talking about some soccer team, either here or overseas. And there's another group you can find, the one I find, that's talking about the Swans or the Giants. And they all have their separate conversations. You know, in the rest of the country, you don't do that. Outside of New South Wales and Queensland, you just turn up and talk about the game. Everyone knows what you're talking about. So that's a bit disappointing. And there's a bit of a class element to the way you have these divided loyalties in New South Wales. You know, it's the private schoolboys who are talking about the Wallabies, and it's the workers talking about league, and the immigrants and the Poms talking about the soccer. Mm-hmm. And they even have a go at the AFL people as being the gay AFL supporters. You know? I have friends who, rugby league friends, who always refer to the gay AFL, jokingly. Now, I object to that on homophobic grounds, of course, but also in defence of my code. They're trying to suggest it's soft, as if there's anything wrong with that. But then, once we settled into Sydney, we started to go to the Swans homes games quite regularly, and our usual companions there were a gay couple, and we met a lot of their gay friends and found out that the Swans actually market deliberately to those the gay communities in Darlinghurst and Paddington. So see what I mean about unifying and egalitarian? That's Aussie rules for you. Having come from Adelaide, loving our footy, obviously loyal to the Crows, we like to go and watch the Swans. We need our fix of footy, so we go along to the Swans home games, and we're happy for them to beat anyone except Adelaide, of course. And a good friend of mine who lives in Sydney, some of you may know, a man by the name of Imre Selezinski. Imre now works for the state government here. And he's a Hawthorn supporter, loves his footy, and he's a Hawthorn supporter. And he told me a great story, a true story. I've checked this out. I won't use any names. But he talked about another person he knew who, like me, had grown up in South Australia and was a Crows supporter, had moved to Sydney and got his regular footy fix at the SCG watching the Swans. The difference was this person was transgender. Having moved to Sydney, he'd become a woman and was going on watching the Swans and barracking for the Swans against anyone but Adelaide. And Imre says he caught up with this person, her now, to chat about footy as they do, and chatting about the Swans and chatting about the Crows. And he said, well, you've been in Sydney for 7 or 8 years now. You're obviously going to stay here. This is where you're going to make your home. Have you thought about perhaps switching from the Crows to the Swans? And she said, oh, no, mate, there's some things you never change. And they both then fell about the place in delayed laughter, realising, of course, just what that said about football loyalty. Excuse me. I'll just grab this drink. Put it. So, for me, footy started very young, like most of us. So we played early. I went on to watch my dad play. Then I'd go and watch dad umpire. My mum was the sports coach for the local school, so she would coach footy teams and umpire some of our games. And you know how hard it is to get a free kick sometimes? When your mum's the umpire, it's bloody hard. But I played footy then deep into my 30s, that is, you know, the age of the 30s, in amateur league and country footy and the like. And early in my career, I tried to have a semi-serious crack at it. I played for the State League in South Australia, tried to, the SANFL, a club called Norwood. This was before the AFL existed. And I'll never forget being picked for my first proper game. I played a lot of trial games, and I got picked for an Anzac Day clash at Adelaide Oval to play for the reserves. And I had a really sore wrist that I'd hurt in a practice game, and the day after I was picked in this first game, the hospital called me back, they'd rechecked my x-rays, it was broken. What do? You shut up about it, of course. You've got a game and you try and play it. And I noticed in the paper, they named the other team was South Adelaide, that I was named on the wing, and they named two wingmen named D. Kapler and D. Kapler. And I thought they'd mucked this up, they'd named the same player on both wings. I rang a mate of mine who was playing at South Adelaide, he says, no, they're brothers. It's Darren Kapler and David Kapler. They'll be on a wing each, you'll be on one of them. I said, what are they like? He said, oh, they're young players, just teenagers. They're going to be okay, but you'll be fine with one of those, no worries. Now, I only have two abiding memories of that game. One is the throbbing wrist. The other is Darren Kapler getting the ball about a metre from me and just sprinting away, bouncing the ball and kicking long into the forward line. He went on to play nearly 200 AFL games at the Swans and Hawthorn. His brother David played nearly 300 league games for South Adelaide. They both played for South Australia in State of Origin. Me, I just went off to the hospital and ended my footy career. The chapter I've written for this book, The Heartfelt Moments, I've focused on my beloved Crows, of course. And I've told the short history of our club. I didn't grow up playing for the Crows. I barracked for a local club, Sturt. The Crows were formed in 1991 and we jumped on from the first game. So I was able in this chapter to tell the whole story of the Crows, including our magnificent premierships in 97 and 98, which seems a long while ago now. But I've bookended the story around this heartfelt moment that you'll all be aware of, and that is the tragic death last year of the Crows coach, the tragic murder of Crows coach Phil Walsh. And the night of his murder, I was at a game in Sydney. The Swans were playing Port Adelaide, and a mate of mine's son plays for the Port side, and we're out there to have a look at the game. And it's funny because Port were having a tough year last year, very much below expectations. And I said to John, his son Tom Jonas plays for Port, I said, jokingly really, because of course the Crows had recruited Phil Walsh as their coach from Port Adelaide, where he was an assistant coach. And my mates and the Port supporters there were really troubled by why Port weren't doing so well this year. And I said, I looked over and said, mate, no Phil Walsh, no Port. And he kind of winced and said, yeah, that might be the case. A lot of people around the club are thinking Port Adelaide are really missing him. Little were we to know, of course, that within a few hours, this tragedy would unfold in Adelaide. And the Adelaide Football Club, the footy community around the country, of course, Phil Walsh's family and friends, all had to muddle on then without Phil after that tragic, tragic incident. It was inspirational, though. I'm certain you all would have seen it, the way sporting clubs, the other AFL clubs, but also local clubs, and not just footy clubs, netball clubs and the like, all got together over those ensuing weeks to signify their support for the Walsh family, their recognition of Phil Walsh, their support for the Adelaide Crows Footy Club, and the recognition of this great man. So it was a really touching time. And what I've talked about in this book, I had the great honour. I spend a lot of time talking to politicians. I'm not very proud of the media most of the time because pretty much we're there to sort of chip everyone down, lop off tall poppies, all that sort of thing. When you're dealing with sport, it's wonderful just to laud excellence, just to revel in the brilliance of some of the people you deal with. So I had a long chat with Mark Rusciuto, the former Adelaide captain, Brownlow medalist, about this game, and it was just wonderful to talk to him about it. And he said something that I found really moving. This is a guy who missed out on the premiership in 97 when he was injured, played in a winning grand final in 98, and was at that game to commemorate Phil Walsh when the Crows played Port Adelaide 2 weeks after his death. And he was at that game as a commentator and as an Adelaide Crows board member. And I said to Mark Rusciuto, that was such a special game. It was such an enormously emotional and brilliant game of football. Perhaps that surely is the Adelaide Crows' greatest victory outside of finals football. And Mark Rusciuto, this Brownlow medalist, a champion that he's been, said, you know, I think, forget everything, all the premierships, I think that game may have been our best win ever for the players to come back and win in those circumstances. And that really spoke to all those other values then about footy. Yes, everyone wants to win grand finals. Yes, everyone wants a premiership. Yes, it's all about success. But for Mark Rusciuto, for that club at that time, both clubs, I should say, at that time, the game was about character, was about friendship, and was about solidarity across the tribes of footy. It was a very special moment and a reminder of what a great game we play and support. Thanks very much for joining us today.
So thanks to Ross Fitzgerald, Gabriel Trainer, and Chris Kinney. There's Janet Grundy's got some copies of Heartfelt Moments in Australian Rules Football with the 37 chapters in it from different people, and I'm sure the authors here tonight would be happy to sign a copy. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got plenty of time. We've got, if we need it, to the top of the hour, but see how we go. I just thought I'd start off with Gabriel, because you had that very amusing anecdote from Sam Kekovich. Now, as I recall, I was there when North Melbourne won their first grand final in 1975, but the team photograph taken after the game, I mean some days after the game, and he has 19 players, Cable's in it, but Kekovich is not. I mean, was he already sort of flogging Lamb, or how did it happen that he didn't turn up for the photograph of the team that won North's first premiership? What did your family say about all that?
Yes, well, it's been the subject of a lot of speculation over the years about where Sam was for that first premiership, you know, 1975, that worked for years and years and years to win, and then Sam was AWOL when the picture was being taken. I think he looks back and regrets it, actually, but I think the fact is he'd met a young lady and got somewhat distracted by her charms.
So he went for the lamb.
Yeah. He went for the lamb. It wasn't the mutton.
Okay, now, folks, if you others come up here, Gabriel, you'll go there.
Thank you.
I'll get on the edge here, and now we come to questions, discussion. Down the back, yeah.
About how AFL is leading the revolution
with female AFL league. How do you feel that Michael Port Adelaide? Oh dear. With Erin Phillips, the daughter of Wayne Phillips from AFL. How do you feel that AFL can lead the other codes in Australia and around the world?
So it's a question about the women's league coming into AFL, and there's a reference there to a particular player. So Gabriel.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for the question, and wonderful to see Yvette Andrews and Lucy Bergman here, who were instrumental in founding the Sydney Women's AFL some, how many years ago? A long time ago now, 16 years ago, which is going from strength to strength. There's no doubt that I think women's football is coming of age, and the intention will be in the next few weeks, actually, for the AFL to call for expressions of interest for licences for eight clubs for women's football. It's incredibly exciting. I think one of the things that's really notable is that sponsors who have never really shown much interest in our code before are lining up because they see how spectacular the women's football is to watch, and just what great role models the women at the elite level are. So it's going to be a really exciting time for AFL. I think in some ways, while women's football has been played in Sydney and all over the place for more than 100 years, other sports have in fact been quicker on the uptake, and it's wonderful to see that the AFL is finally looking at it as a serious sibling sport, if you like, and will embrace it and no doubt make a great success of it.
So down the centre front of the camera, yes?
As a rugby tragic, I lived in Melbourne for a while, and I was interested. AFL is a much more a family game. Why is that the case? Why are children, family, mums, dads, everybody? Why are they all family game?
So why is AFL a more family game than, say, union? Yeah. Chris, come talk to me.
I'm not certain that anyone could really answer that, but obviously I spoke a bit about that in my presentation, and the other side of that, the point I forgot to mention, I think it's also always had a stronger buy-in from women. If you go to Aussie Rules crowds, it's always pretty much 50-50 male and female. In the Aussie Rules culture, certainly families get involved right from the start. It's women are involved in sort of coaching or managerial roles and running around. As Gabriel says, it's great to see that more are getting to actually play the game now, because I've certainly in the past more would have wanted to. Certainly my sisters would have loved to have lined up. But I don't know that we know the answer, but I think it's a real strength of the game and something we've got to continue to encourage.
Mm. And one thing that's not properly understood is that of all of the codes, Aussie Rules supporters actually read books and buy books. That's true.
I might add that's very Labour. I just wanted to say that whenever I talk to people who don't know anything about Aussie Rules, they tell me watching it is very confusing on television. they can't see how the game works. Are there any thoughts about this? Since we live in a TV age, it is a sport, if you know about it, it moves all over the ground, whereas the other sports take a long time to move anywhere, so they go very well on the screen. So what could be done to make Aussie rules more accessible to those who don't understand?
The suggestion is that Aussie rules is a bit hard to understand watching on television here.
I agree with you, Anne. It's a game much better viewed at the ground. So I think once you've been to a few games and can actually see how the strategy develops across the ground and how the players are actually made, then you can, I think, enjoy it quite happily on television. So I suppose my message to people would be, come along. Come along and see what it's like live, and perhaps you'll never want to watch it on television again, except for replays when the team wins.
And I suppose if... I have my doubts, but if the citizenry can understand those dreadful Senate reforms and how to vote for the Senate, that people can actually understand the game of football.
I think one of the technical point of Chris. This, Anne, is that Aussie rules is about the only footy code that doesn't have any sort of offside. There's no sort of line that players can't cross. Players can attack and defend at will. So, and that's one of the great strengths of the game. And a little anecdote from my wife, who works just a couple of buildings down the road. She was just mentioning the other day that a lot of the young blokes in her legal firm have just started playing in an Aussie rules competition, and most of these guys have played touch or rugby league in the past and are just taking up Aussie rules socially for the first time. And a couple of them came back to the office the day after their first practice and said, bloody hell, there's people coming at you from all directions. So it's not just difficult to watch when you're in the middle. There is no offside. People come from any direction.
But talking about the law, I mean, I find it absolutely unbelievable that in Aussie rules at a senior level, there's no send-off rule. So there's been, no matter what you do, a very important player and coach broke the jaw of a Geelong player. He got arrested when he finally came off the ground. But there's no... I find it amazing that there's no send-off rule.
See,
and in fact, there's another case, a friend of mine, believe it or not, who in his last game, and he had no plans for going into country football, he just cleaned up about four or five people in his last game, and there's nothing they could do.
Ross, could I just point out that if they brought in a send-off rule, it would be the end of your beloved Collingwood.
I'm tempted to follow up on the people who change their teams. My father, my brother, and one of my lifelong best friends have all done that in the course of the Swans, but I still get on the plane and go down and watch Collingwood every week. But what I'd like to ask about, and I guess somebody was always going to ask about booing, is booing. Now, my question rises because in the same month as Adam Hooks was vilified last year, and he really was vilified, I was at Carlton Collingwood, and the Collingwood supporters were booing Chris Judd just as vehemently on that night. Now, the players of similar vintages and probably equally glorious careers, and I'm pleased to say that the friend I was standing with in the Collingwood Social Club at the time took a dim view of the
future. Okay, we got it. Yeah.
But what do you think, one or other, was more despicable than why?
Because the question about booing, there's a suggestion. Well, we all know that Adam Goods was booed, but the suggestion that at a game Chris Judd was also booed just as loudly. That's the suggestion. Right, who Gary? Wants to respond?
Booing is a fine tradition in AFL, of course, but I think the difference between the booing that you cited of Chris Judd and Adam Goods was that if the people booing Goods thought for one instant there was a risk that it could have been interpreted as racist, much less was racist, then it absolutely should not have happened.
In terms of the first half of your question about friends of yours that changed teams, the time that I really understood the dubious character of the Archbishop, Archbishop Hollingworth in Brisbane, was when I took him down to see the then Brisbane Bears and he changed sides.
Dick,
to Gabrielle... In American football at the moment, they're trying out a chip that they attach to all the players that monitors continuously how fast they're running, how hard they're being hit, their heart rate. Any thoughts of bringing that sort of technology into Australian football?
I think it's pretty well already being used. Okay. You'll notice that there's a little pouch at the back of the players' guernseys nowadays, and there are monitoring devices in those little pouches. So, no, the science behind, gathering data in football now is just incredibly sophisticated, and we're learning a lot from what's happening in the US.
Is it being shown on the telly?
Ross, speak to the camera.
I'm just asking Gabby, but is it being shown on the television?
I think occasionally they'll show elements of it, but mainly it's for the coaching staff, obviously. Yeah.
Right, so question here? Yeah.
Really, in the vein of Jack's question, somewhat serious, you were the only one to acknowledge acknowledgement to country, and I'm sure that was an omission by Chris unintentionally and Ross. How much, looking back on the contributors, let alone the spectators, the subject of the book, do you think they think we must continually and infinitely and definitely acknowledge to country?
Well, I don't think that's quite a question about the book, but you can answer it if you want to.
I don't think there's any doubt that Aboriginal players have contributed enormously to Australian football. They're well overrepresentative numerically among the teams. My grandfather had the honour of actually introducing Doug Nicholls, one of the first AFL players, to the then VFA when he was president of the Northcote Football Club. Doug Nicholls couldn't get a run at a then VFL club in those days, and he then played a premiership in 1929 for Northcote. But he's just one of so many Indigenous players. I think they add immeasurably to the richness of our game. But I think broader diversity is what the AFL, of course, is aiming for as well. It's not only women, it's not only Indigenous people who create the fabric of our game. It's all sorts of groups in the community that we want to embrace as a code.
A key part of Dick Whittaker's contribution is in fact about Pastor Doug Nicholls. Who did he play for first with the VFL?
Fitzroy.
And he was very badly treated there, wasn't he?
Yeah. No, he was treated well at Fitzroy. Hayden Button actually befriended him.
Right, but he was at a previous club, wasn't he?
Yes, and he was.
Which was that?
I think that was Carlton.
Yeah, so he got ostracised by Carlton, but he did, accepted by Fitzroy.
Yeah.
Chris?
Douglas Nicholls, of course, went on to be Governor of South Australia, which again emphasises, we're talking about his footy career here, we had our priorities right in this country. He's remembered more as a footballer than as a governor. But I do want to address these Indigenous issues. No, I didn't forget to recognise the traditional owners. I just didn't see it as an Indigenous event, so I wouldn't recognise it. Yes, the booing of Adam Goods was absolutely deplorable in the end, but I don't think it started off. I don't think it was racially based, and I think some people inflame the situation by saying the crowds were being racist. It started off because he's the sort of player opposition teams like to boo, because he attracts attention to himself, he's bloody good, and you like to bring him down. But the point was, I think, exactly as Gabriel said, when the controversy erupted, and as soon as crowds realised it was being taken in this racist way, could be taken in this racist way, as my friend Stan Grant said, as soon as we knew how it made him feel, then we should have stopped. And sadly, some crowds didn't. And it's just a terribly sad thing in his final year that this is what happened. And just finally, on Indigenous people and our game, I don't think anybody who follows Aussie rules can escape just the amazing impact that Indigenous players have on our game. As a child growing up, I idolised Roger Rigney and Michael Graham. As an adult, I idolised Andrew McLeod and Eddie Betts. I had a great occasion on Saturday night where I got to meet Michael O'Loughlin. But it's not just the numbers of Indigenous players in our game, it's the quality that they've shown in their athleticism and their leadership capabilities. I think it's a very special... I know there are a lot of Indigenous rugby league players, but in Aussie rules, Indigenous players have contributed something additional, I think. They're really strongly recognised in our code for that.
And for what it's worth, I think two of the very strong pieces in the book are Mickey O'Loughlin's piece about his inspirational journey with number 37, but also my friend Andrew Ireland, the CEO. Is he the CEO of the Swans still? Yeah. Writing about, he played in three losing and one drawn grand final, and he writes about what it was like playing for Collingwood in the 1977 drawn grand final and then losing afterwards. I think that Mickey O'Loughlin's piece is absolutely brilliant, but Andrew Ireland's piece is equally as good.
Peter.
Jared, can I just pick up on Chris? Adam Woods played 300 games before he started the boot. He was only booed after he, number one, called out that that person at the Collingwood game for calling him an effing ape, and secondly, after Eddie Maguire spoke about Goods
King
likening
Kong.
Him to an ape. Now, and he escaped without any sort of sanction.
Oh, yeah,
the AFL didn't sanction him, his club didn't sanction him, neither did the television stations or radio stations that he worked for.
I'm not here to defend Eddie Maguire, and he apologised for those horrible comments, but I don't think Adam Goods was initially booed because of a racist element in the crowd. I think there's been a lot of booing for prominent players from the opposition a lot of the time.
Not, you wouldn't see... Exactly,
and that's my point. It escalated, and it escalated to a horrible point, and that's when people should have realised it had got out of hand and stopped it without anybody needing to advise them.
Okay, so who's... question here, yep.
To Chris and Gabriel, you were talking about how the Sydney sporting market is fractured, but it's also been referred to as one of the most competitive sporting markets in the world because of the number of winter codes of football that are played here in an organised fashion. So with the advent of the Giants, do you see that there is... in the future a very good prospect of AFL gaining ground on the other codes by that rivalry, you know, gaining more support around the city as a whole?
Well, I hope it already is. I mean, I think the Giants and the Swans are now becoming real rivals. Now the Giants have been in the game for about 5 years, and they've already beaten the Swans once. I think, you know, there genuinely is rivalry. You know, there are 2.5 million people in the west of Sydney. Obviously, not all of them are going to be interested in AFL, but we hope a lot of them put AFL on their menu. I think, it's a wonderful sporting environment in Sydney. There are so many codes you can support. You know, you don't have to be exclusively one. But I think there's no doubt that the strategy behind the development of the Giants was to create that rivalry, to have a game in Sydney as many weeks as possible, and to really try and, you know, lift AFL's share of the market here, and I think we're well on the way to do that.
You're right, it is very, very competitive, but I'm really encouraged by what's going on here. Chris Bowen's chapter in the book talks about that first game the Giants beat the Swans. That is their biggest moment so far. That says a lot about where the rivalry's going. I've had a beer on the terraces out there with Chris Bowen. He goes with his daughter to every Giants home game. He's not there in the corporate box doing the political thing. His daughter loves the Giants and he's into it. We have a sports minister here, I know, who played 200 or so Aussie Rules games for Penrith. So we've just got to keep proselytising and beat these other ball-throwing codes.
Ross? So tell us... Oh, Dick, yes.
My views,
oh, for me. But I'm... Yeah, okay.
Yes,
no, that's fair enough.
Yeah. I'm the greatest footballer.
Well, I think that was the question. It was a question about John Coleman that Dick said was the greatest ever full forward. And I wrote about, Ross asked me to write about John Coleman and the fact he got suspended in 1951 when I'd just turned six, or just before, and I've never forgotten it, and I've written about it. It was a heartfelt moment. I mean, I think he got unfairly suspended. After all, he only hit a Carlton player. And the Carlton player wasn't particularly good. And he got suspended for 4 weeks, which took him out of the 1951 grand final, which Essendon almost certainly would have won, having won in 49 and 50. And he was one of my heroes, as was Norm Macdonald, who was one of the first Indigenous star Australian footballers, who was an absolute star in the finals games for Essendon. Not great always through the season, but an absolute star in the finals, which is where true talent is tested. So I wrote about how I've never got over that, and I still haven't got over it, and I think about it quite a lot. In fact, there are only two things in life as I reflect back I haven't got over, and they're not so long ago, really. There's Coleman suspension, which is only 65 years ago, and the Reformation, which is only 400 years ago. So I haven't quite got over either of them. So tell me, Ross, how hard was it to get people to write like Chris Bowen and Julie Bishop and George Pell and who all the others you've got in the book, John Burton. How hard was it to get people to write for you?
Well, my strongest point and my weakest point is the same, persistence. I'm very, very persistent. And it wasn't all that difficult. The one person I am sad about who was too busy was Professor Geoffrey Blainey. I would have very much liked Geoffrey, who's written wonderfully about Aussie rules football, to be in the book. But, I had some trouble with a Courier Mail journalist who wanted a bag load of money to write about the Brisbane Lions, and nobody got paid. We all got 6 free copies of the book.
Now, there's a question on the back, yes.
On that score of who you got to write, Ross, I didn't hear a contribution from the second oldest football club on the planet.
So there's no contribution from the second oldest football club on the planet, which is...
You don't know?
No, I don't, no.
The Geelong Football Club.
Geelong Football Club.
Well, that's...
No, Anthony Capello, the publisher, has written about Geelong. And there's a lot about the Hawthorne... the Hawthorne rivalry with Geelong, so that's not true.
And Geelong defeated Essendon in the 1951 Grand Final.
Yes,
no, which I have complained about.
Yeah. Yes. And Jared has mentioned.
Yes.
I did an earlier version. My first collection of writings about Australian rules football was in the early 1980s. And there was a wonderful article by Brent Croswell about sex before the game. He didn't, because he couldn't at the time, write about sex during the game that happened, that actually happened with a star Collingwood player who was playing in Tasmania. But when the book...
pretty good interchange, Bench.
When that book got some publicity, I was on Kerri-Ann Kennelly's show and I was in the last segment. And Lou Richards was on and some people talked about, you know, whether having sex before the game was a good thing or a bad thing. And Gerard Healy, who won the Brownlow Medal that particular year, I think, said he thought that sex before the game was a very useful thing. And Kerri-Ann Kennelly closed up the program by saying, well, listen, all the best for the game tomorrow, Gerard. And he said, I'm not playing. And she said, why not? He said, I've done in my groin.
That's true. Yes, I hope you'll bring some decorum now.
It's the only football code, certainly in this country, where you get mum's dad, Sir Robert Menzies, the cleaner at the hospital, whatever. Everybody's part of it. The first thing I noticed when I came to Sydney was that the football codes up here did not have anything like that. And it's also, to my mind, maybe the only football code that can ever produce a book like that, because all the people that follow AFL are from such vibrantly different backgrounds.
Well, I think that might be a nice way to end up. So let's go in reverse order. So we start with Chris and Gabriel, and then with Ross. Yeah, Chris.
Yes, and just to I suppose emphasise that point. My recollections are, so some people might be surprised to know that 20, 30 years ago, whenever it was, I was an ABC journalist, and I did a story on the emerging national competition for the ABC 7:30 report. And I got to interview two people. Well, one was outsourced for me. I think Barry Cassidy picked it up for me. But I got to interview Bob Santa Maria and old mate Manning Clark. Bob Santa Maria and Manning Clark at opposite ends in the same story, both lifelong Carlton supporters.
Gabriel.
I think you're absolutely right, and it's just the magic of our game. It strikes the heart chords of anybody, no matter who you are. Sir Robert hasn't been to a game for a while, but nonetheless, it is the sort of game that, you know, it's the one conversation that everybody, no matter who you are, can have, and that's why we love it.
Ross? Yes, as far as I know, my father never read a book. He read comics. The only book in our house was The Power of Positive Thinking, which remained unopened. But we would often talk about football. My birthday's Christmas Day, Our Garbo was Bob Chitty, the hard man from Carlton. And my dad, and he never swore my father, but every Christmas Day he'd tell the story about how Bob Chitty, as Ron Todd, the Grateful Ford, was going up, that Bob Chitty squirrel munched him, bit him on the nuts, right? And I'd written about that in the Weekend Australian, and I was the guest speaker when down at Carrara, and I mentioned that a bit, and whoever was running it said, oh, well, Ron Todd's down the back. And he was a great hero of my father's, so I wanted to go and say hello. But everybody was around him, so I said, hello, Mrs. Todd, my name's Ross Fitzgerald. And she said, you're that dreadful person who wrote those terribly untrue things about my late husband, Bob Chitty. I was the only one on the ground that didn't know that Ron Todd had married Chitty's widow.
Well, I met Ron Todd and his wife, but I never raised this matter. But he looked like he was still flying pretty high, so I don't think Chitty did much damage. Probably never got near him. Anyway, look, many thanks to Ross Fitzgerald, to Gabriel Trainer and Chris Kinney for a fun night tonight. As I said, the copies of the books are around. I'm sure they'll be happy to sign them. But for tonight, well done to the three of you, and thanks.
Thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.